From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's our lineup for today. The Lucas Museum won't open until late next year, but it already has acquired a significant collection of Black American film ephemera. Then the music supervisor of the Broadway show Moulin Rouge! The Musical has a personal connection to Baz Luhrmann's 2001 film.
The first time I saw Moulin Rouge! Was at a drama club sleepover, and I got to third base while watching that movie.
And why did actress Mary Steenburgen start another career as a songwriter? It's The Frame. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Lucas Museum hasn't yet opened its doors, but the narrative art space just announced a major acquisition, an extensive archive of Black American cinema, movie posters, and film stills called Separate Cinema. The Lucas Museum is currently under construction at Exposition Park near downtown LA. It's scheduled to open in late 2021. The museum's film curator is Ryan Linkoff. Ryan, welcome to The Frame.
Thank you for having me.
The collection is called Separate Cinema. Can you explain what's behind the name and how it defines what is included in the archive?
We were actually just having this conversation with the founder of the archive, John Kish. The name comes kind of out of a specific historical moment, specifically the kind of first half of the 20th century, the 20s, 30s, and 40s in particular, which saw the proliferation of a film industry really defined around African-American filmmakers, producers, directors, actors, really kind of films made for and by an African-American audience. And in a way, those existed outside of the mainstream methods of making movies and the distribution channels. So they really were in some ways a kind of separate track of film production, distribution, and consumption. For that reason, I think it's a way of kind of identifying the ways in which a film industry kind of developed for a particular market that is in some ways obviously always entwined in a broader mainstream history, but also has its own kind of internal integrity. That said, the materials in the collection are both made by Black filmmakers for Black audiences, and obviously films produced by the mainstream, majority white film production industry for broader audiences as well.
I'm going to play a clip from a film from 1943. It's called A Cabin in the Sky. It starred Lena Horne, Ethel Waters, and Eddie Anderson. Interestingly, it was directed by Vincente Minnelli, who did Gigi and American in Paris. But let's listen to this good example of what you're talking about in terms of separate cinema. It's a scene from A Cabin in the Sky.
You'll hurry along, won't you?
Oh, we'll be there all right.
And Reverend, when you call on the sinners to confess, you'd better assign me the rest of the evening.
Oh, you're not that bad, Joseph.
Oh, not my sheep, come back home. When the sin washed by the foam, shepherd told him through the door, he saved him.
So when you think about this period in film history, why is this period so important in understanding how we got where we are today?
I would say it's really, in some ways, essential to understand the ways in which especially the Hollywood studio system both developed a culture of representing African Americans that was, on the one hand, quite pernicious in the ways that it represented very entrenched stereotypes of the African American experience. And on the other, there were attempts, such as Cabin in the Sky, to produce films that were at least making an attempt to speak in more sensitive and thoughtful ways to an African American audience, by featuring major iconic figures, both within the African-American community and also figures who had a broader kind of popular appeal. And this kind of push-pull, this tension between trying to both represent the African-American experience and also kind of in some ways exploiting and capitalizing on particular stereotypes, I think are really kind of something that we're continue to live with and continues to play itself out in certain ways. And I think understanding this broader history, especially that kind of early phase, the first half of the 20th century, when the entire film industry in some ways was most thoroughly coming into shape, I think really helps us understand and explain where we are at the present moment.
We're talking with Ryan Linkoff, film curator for the Lucas Museum. I want to ask you about the collection itself. There are thousands of items in it. What was John Kish up to, and how did he assemble all of these things?
Well, so he's been collecting really since, I believe, the 1970s, and acquiring this collection piece by piece through a variety of different outlets, through auctions, through private collections. And he did develop what is by most measures the most impressive and comprehensive archive of material related to African American cinema, really with the intent of creating an archive that was available for both scholarly research and also public programming and exhibitions to really highlight, celebrate, explore, and examine the broader history of African American cinema across the 20th century and into the 21st. And he continues to be in conversations with us as new things come to auction and that kind of thing. So we really want to continue that legacy and also make it in the same ways accessible for the research and for the contextualization of the history of African American cinema.
I want to play a clip from another movie that is a seminal example of Black cinema. This is 1989's Do the Right Thing. In this scene, we're going to hear from a character named Radio Raheem, who's played by Bill Nunn.
One hand is always fighting the other hand, and the left hand is kicking much ass. I mean, it looks like the right hand love is finished. But hold on, stop the presses, the right hand's coming back. Yeah, he got the left hand on the ropes now, that's right. Yeah, ooh, it's a devastating right hand, hate is hurt, he's down. Ooh, ooh, left hand, hey, KO'd by love.
I love this scene, and it made me wonder about how much film presentation and screenings will be part of what this collection is going to be about. Are people going to be able to see movies? Are you going to do screenings and conversations around those films?
So film programming will be a major part of the Lucas Museum's mission going forward. We will have two state-of-the-art theaters for film programming. And it's great that you played a clip from Do the Right Thing, because we are actually organizing a film program in February, February 8th, that will feature Do the Right Thing as well as The Wiz. We act as a collaboration with the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and this is really our first attempt at putting together a film program.
I think you're scheduled to open in late 2021. We know maybe the Academy Museum hasn't quite met its deadlines. Are you pretty hopeful that we will have a museum by the end of next year?
We are on schedule to be substantially complete with construction by the end of 2021. We haven't announced an actual opening date for the public, but everything's moving ahead.
Ryan Linkoff is film curator for the Lucas Museum, which just acquired the Separate Cinema Archive, a collection of Black American cinema. Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Coming up on The Frame, Moulin Rouge the movie had a lot of pop songs. Moulin Rouge the musical has a lot more. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Justin Levine is a musical theater composer, lyricist, and arranger. He's also the music supervisor for the current Broadway production, Moulin Rouge the Musical, which earned him and his colleagues a Grammy nomination for Best Musical Theater Album. The show is based on Baz Luhrmann's iconic 2001 film, but with a lot more songs than the movie. So I asked Levine about his rulebook for adapting the film's story and its songs, in particular, the film's most celebrated piece, Elephant Love Medley.
I would say there was only one rule, and that was that the lyrics were of the utmost importance. And so while we certainly were looking for songs that were popular or that would be recognizable to the majority of our audience, it was really important that the lyrics served story and character.
I'm going to play a snippet of an iconic song. First, we're going to hear the film version. Then we're going to hear your Broadway version of the same song.
There's no way, 'cause you can't pay. I won't give in to you.
Don't leave me this way.
Okay, that's the movie version. Now the Broadway version.
There's no way, 'cause you can't pay.
In the name of love, one night in the name of love.
You crazy fool, I won't give in to you.
It's so easy. All you have to do is fall in love.
Love hurts.
All you have to do is play the game.
Love scars.
All you have to do is take on.
No, no,
so, fair to say, AHA was not in the movie version. So
that is correct.
How did you approach that song? Because it is both very similar and radically different.
My feeling was we needed to honor the Elephant Love medley. We needed to use as much of it as we could. And that at some point, really where in the film they go into Love Lifts Us Up Where We Belong, I felt like we needed to go on this larger journey for the stage if we're closing act one with this number. And so the way I began building that number was I made a list of all of the love songs and anti-love songs I could think of, and I printed up all the lyrics
for
them.
That's going to be a long list.
Yes.
That's basically every piece of pop music.
It's a lot. It was a lot. And actually what I ended up doing was I looked at how in the film Christian sings a line from a song and then Satine sings it back, but with different lyrics to refute his point.
It's basically a game. It's like a word
right,
game.
Exactly. And I had the idea, what if actually Satine brought in some of her own music into this battle? And so we start similarly to the way it does in the film. And then basically at that point that you mentioned, I have Christian singing an aha song, and then Satine responds, "No, no, no, it ain't me, babe.
No, 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 it ain't me.
Take me on."
He says, "Take me on," and then she says, "No, no, no, because you'll be gone in a day or two."
In a day or two.
So she actually snatches the aha song from him and uses those words against him. And so, you know, this became really an exciting way to tell that story. And so what I did was, as I looked through these lyrics, and I'm talking about hundreds of pages, I was circling things, highlighting things, and then I started cutting them up, literally cutting them up and putting them on the floor of my office. And so I built this conversation that finishes the beat of the scene much in the way that you would if you were writing an original song for a musical.
What's fundamentally different for people who love the movie as much as I do is that it's less of a game in the musical. It is more of a debate. It's an argument. And that Satine has a lot more agency lyrically than she did in the movie. That it's more a battle of equals.
Right. I'm so glad to hear you say that. Thank you. That was definitely the goal. And, you know, one of the nicest things that Baz and Craig Pierce and some of the other collaborators from the film said is that
Craig Pierce is the co-screenwriter of the movie.
Correct, yeah. And they said that they could see that this was coming from a place of love. And it really was, because I think that moment is just one of the most legendary moments in cinema.
We're talking with Justin Levine about Moulin Rouge, the musical. I want to play another new sequence in the musical. This one features a band that some people might recognize pretty quickly.
But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Well, I saw you today at the reception. A glass of wine in your hand.
That, of course, is the Rolling Stones, and this is the Duke trying to, I guess, win the affections of Satine. I remember Baz saying that he couldn't get the Rolling Stones on board for the film. So how did you do what Baz was unable to accomplish?
Well, it wasn't easy. There was a lot of negotiating. And actually, I'm as shocked as I think Baz or anybody else would have been that they ultimately accepted. But essentially, I made a proposal, which was that I would make a medley that was exclusively Rolling Stone songs. Their response was, make something and send it to us, and then we'll get back to you. And so I was in Germany, and I just had my laptop with me and a keyboard. And so I went on GarageBand, and I got a USB microphone from a music shop, and I sat down, and I made a full demo of it from a closet in Germany.
I remember when Pixar released the first Toy Story movie, nobody had any idea what they were up to, and they wanted Barbie, and Mattel said, no way, we're not giving you Barbie. And then the movie came out, and it's like, well, of course we're giving you Barbie for every other Toy Story movie. And I'm wondering, does the success of the movie conceptually and critically help in those negotiations, that people know essentially how this is going to work, even though they haven't seen the musical, they know the movie, they know the conceit?
I think it must have, because, you know, when you think about the fact that we used 71 songs, it's pretty astounding. These are some of the, you know, most famous artists in the world. And many of our sort of bigger artists were the first to get back to us. I was pretty amazed. I mean, we certainly, you know, had plenty of songs that we didn't get the rights to, but actually, the vast majority said yes.
I want to play one song that you didn't get. I hope it's not too painful, but let's listen to this song. I'm too hot. Call the police and the fireman. I'm too hot. That's Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. And people need to understand that when it comes to licensing songs, for a song like that, you're licensing the composition. And the composition of Uptown Funk is by 11 people. I think 10 people said yes, except one, and his name is Bruno Mars.
That's right. That is right. you know, I completely forget that, you know, that we had it in the show for so long before we lost that song. And, you know, it's interesting because it's one of the challenges of doing a show this way is that we had to simultaneously go through the rights process while also building the score, which meant that I had to go into it knowing that this was bound to happen. But, you know, the thing about Moulin Rouge, and I would say this about the film as well, is that it's bigger than just one song, right? No one song can hold up the show. Although, you know, obviously what you want to find is a song that feels essential in that moment. And so that doesn't mean that we were going to settle for just sliding something in. You know, it meant that I would have to go back into my hole and really dig far deeper to figure it out.
I want to ask you one last question, and that is, both personally and professionally, what Moulin Rouge has meant to you from the first time you saw the film to opening night of the musical?
Well, that's a great question, and I hope I can say this on the air. So the first time I saw Moulin Rouge was at a drama club sleepover, and I got to third base while watching that movie. I remember that night very clearly, and watching that movie. And really, I think when your song came on, that was the real moment that hooked me in. I was growing up listening to music from, you know, the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And when your song came on, that was a song that I knew and I loved. And what was so brilliant about it was that it carries with it everything that I was bringing to the song, and the role that that song plays in my emotional life. And so it really ups the ante when you're experiencing that.
Well, as we go out, let's listen to your arrangement of your song from Moulin Rouge, the musical. Justin Levine is the show's music supervisor, arranger, orchestrator, and lyricist. Justin, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
So excuse me for getting. But these things
up next on The Frame, you know Mary Steenburgen from her many TV and film roles, but did you know she's also a songwriter?
Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. On the new NBC show Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, Jane Levy plays a young woman who, after a freak accident, can suddenly hear the thoughts of other people, but she hears them as songs. Levy's mother is played by Mary Steenburgen, who had a real-life episode that resulted in music taking over her brain, and it led to the veteran actress launching a new career as a songwriter. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving has her story.
Is You see, I mean, I just literally, this is what I do all day. I play weird French little cafe riffs.
Mary Steenburgen is playing the accordion for me at her home in the Pacific Palisades.
I'm just making something up badly.
If you know her from dramatic roles like Melvin and Howard or as Doc Brown's love interest in Back to the Future Part 3, the image of Mary Steenburgen playing the accordion and writing songs may surprise you. How this all came about certainly surprised her.
In April 2007, I had a surgery on my arm, and it wasn't a huge deal, but it did require that I went under general anesthetic. When I came out from under the surgery, my arm felt fine, but my brain felt strange. And the best way I can describe it is that the sound of my mind for my whole life was different, and it was replaced with this sort of overscored movie. It felt like people's conversations turned musical, people's questions to me, the answer was somehow musical, street signs. It was like a musical tornado. And it was fairly terrifying and definitely utterly absorbing. I remember just looking in the mirror and saying, you know, it's not going away. So you've got to figure this out because you've got four kids. They count on you. You have a husband, you have a career, and you can't go nuts. You know, you have to make sense of it. I didn't know what to do other than just start studying how people wrote songs.
That husband she mentioned is Ted Danson, you know, from Cheers and The Good Place.
We flew to Europe with friends to go on this 2-week kind of holiday. We were in Italy driving in a van to go to the hotel. And I knew she had written a song that night while I slept on the plane. But she said, hey, I wrote a song. Do you mind if I sing it to you? And, you know, everyone kind of literally or metaphorically kind of rolled their eyes and went, yes, of course, of course. And out came this really remarkable song. By the end of the summer, she'd written, I don't know, 40, 50 songs. And it truly was like I was married to somebody else.
I broke up with a man in the moon last night. Had enough of his whimsical smile.
She sang the music that was swirling in her head into a tape recorder. Then professional musicians translated those ideas into songs. Pretty soon, she'd signed a publishing deal with Universal, went to Nashville, and started churning out dozens of songs with co-writers.
I actually think it was more physical than magical. I feel like I connected to a part of my mind that I just didn't have access to before.
Which brings us to Wild Rose, the movie starring Jessie Buckley as a troublemaking young mom from Glasgow, Scotland, who desperately wants to go to Nashville to become a country music star.
I'm trying to be a country singer.
Nobody wants to see a convicted criminal up there.
Johnny Cash is a convicted criminal, you ball bag.
The movie needed a song for the big finale after Buckley's character, Rose Lynn, gets to Nashville and realizes there's no place like home. Steenburgen saw the call for song submissions through Universal. Inspired, she wrote the song Glasgow with two Nashville singer-songwriters, Caitlin Smith and Kate York. She pulled her iPad out and played me the original demo. This is Caitlin Smith singing.
I've worn out the stones in front of your doorstep. Come in and go. Come in and go away. Come in and go.
She's so freaking talented that I was scared that I said, I hope your voice is not too good to be sending in because it's intimidating. No one sounds like this. But then we saw this rehearsal of Jessie and we were all blown away, just blown away.
Had to
write something in a room in Nashville, Tennessee, and it goes over to Scotland, and this Irish girl is singing it, and somehow you're all totally connected to it. You all own it.
Ted Danson is kind of in awe of his wife.
The biggest lesson, I think, was her willingness to say yes. It would have been much more reasonable to say, well, I'm not going to start writing music at 50, whatever she was. That's silly. I'm not going to have a publishing deal with a major label that's ridiculous. I can't go step into these Nashville artists who have been doing this all their lives and expect to be accepted. Everything was unreasonable, and yet she said yes to life.
Among the things Mary Steenburgen said yes to recently, she's writing the songs for an animated film called The Underneath. She'd also like to learn how to play the guitar.
It's much more useful to play the guitar, but I'm not good at stringed instruments, at least not so far. That's going to require another surgery.
That was a joke, she let me know. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And a bit of news before we go. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced this year's inductees today, and they include the British band T-Rex, founded by the late Mark Bolan, rocks the hardest of any of the new inductees. The other honorees include Whitney Houston, the Notorious B.I.G., the Doobie Brothers, Depeche Mode, and Nine Inch Nails. And that'll do it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks so much for listening. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.